this is my moment to say, like, I don't have to be a change agent. I don't have to write serious, hard stories, A, to have a job, and B, to claim the title of writer.
What's good? I'm Nikisha Elise Williams, and this is Black and Published, bringing you the journeys of writers, poets, playwrights, and storytellers of all kinds. Today's guest is Laurie L. Tharps, an author of four books now living abroad in Spain, where she learned the true meaning of her new profession as a ghostwriter.
The idea is a ghostwriter does all the work and gets no credit, like a slave, like a black person. And so it feels pejorative. It feels racist. Because
as hell.
You're saying the work I'm doing is, again, you're doing all the work, you get no credit. And who does that kind of work? Black people, right?
With previous careers in magazine writing, editing, freelancing, and academia, Laurie is now finally living her creative life on her own terms. Why she first believed that her work had to move Black people forward. Plus, in grappling with her ego, Laurie shares her vision to make the ghostwriting community more visible. And the new platform she's launched to connect BIPOC writers to their literary history around the world. That and more is next when Black and Published continues.
All right. So first off, when did you know that you were a writer?
I knew I was a writer when I was 8 years old and my mother came home from a rummage sale, which is what she usually would do on Saturdays. And she brought me an antique Remington typewriter. And for the life of me, and I've even asked her this since, you know, why did she give it to me? I have an older sister. Before this time, I did not walk around saying I wanted a typewriter. I did not say I wanted to be a writer, but she gifted it to me. I mean, and this is a beautiful typewriter and it worked. You know, you had to crank it, you know, put the paper in, the ink and everything. As soon as I put my fingers on those keys and saw a story that came out of my head onto the page, I was hooked. I wrote all the time. I wrote stories. I wrote plays. I wrote productions for every holiday gathering. My mother has 10 sisters. So like any family gathering was like a crowd. And we had the biggest house. So it was always at our house. And I always had a play. And I would make all my cousins play a part. And I was the star. I was like Spike Lee before Spike Lee or Tyler Perry before Tyler Perry. I was like star director, writer,
producer.
Yes. And I would even type out the programs and they'd always say a Laurie Way production for my name. I was like, and I had a logo even. So I
so much.
Just loved to write it up, like put it down on paper. Again, stories, plays, whatever was in my head, to see it on the page to me was like magical.
Do you still have that typewriter? And does it still work?
It's literally right. It's one of the few things I brought with me when I moved to Spain. I had it cleaned and upgraded, if you will, like tuned up. Like I got it a tune up. There was like one place in Philadelphia that actually still serviced manual old fashioned typewriters. And I took it there, got it all ready to be shipped. And it's still with me. And I just got a dog and I named my dog Remington.
Aww.
Because that's the typewriter. So. Yeah.
That's awesome. So then knowing at 8 years old that you wanted to write, that was the only thing that you were going to do, what does that look like in your journey and your career?
It's interesting because, I mean, I was a voracious reader. So I think that obviously played into the fact of, you know, why I liked writing so much. But I read all the time. My best friend and I would, you know, trade books from the time I was like 5 or 6, Archie Comics, the Bowers, the Littles, Laura Ingalls Wilder, like all those, you know, series books. So I thought I was going to be a novelist. Like that was my dream, was to be a fiction writer. But I went to college and I could have been an English major. But my first creative writing class was a short story class. And it's funny because I tell this story and I'm like, I got a C in the class. And that's what made me never decide that I wasn't good enough to be a writer. But recently I looked at my transcripts, like I when I was moving to Spain, I had to, you know, go through on my class. I didn't get a C in the class. I got a B. But in my mind, because I guess because I didn't get an A, which I don't always, I wasn't like an A student, but because I didn't excel in the creative writing class, and I remember getting some like strong criticism on one of my stories, I thought that meant I didn't have talent as a writer. Mm. So that was like my freshman year. So I declared a major in education. I was like going to be a teacher, and then I was going to just work my way up into education administration. And I just said, I will just write for myself on the side. It wasn't until I spent my junior year of college in Spain where all those lovely siestas, you know, like you just have so much time to hang out. I like had a come to Jesus moment with myself where, because I had all this time to really just reflect on who I was and what was important to me, and I had met so many interesting people from all over the world who didn't have that hustle mindset like we did in the US, I was like, I love writing so much. I'm going to give myself a chance to be a writer. And if it doesn't work out, I can be a teacher or do whatever else. But this thing is what I love to do. And so I owe it to myself to try to pursue that passion. So when I came back to the US, I had one more year of college left, and my parents were not going to pay for an extra year of college. Like, you graduate and do whatever you want. You want to be a writer? That's fine. But do it on your own time and not on our dime. So basically, I went into journalism because to me, that was, you know, I still had this belief that I couldn't be a fiction writer. Also, a fiction writer wasn't an actual job. And, you know, the gravy train was done after college. I'm like, I was on my own. So I was like, journalist is a writer with a job. So who gets a paycheck? So I said, that's what I'm going to do. And then went to graduate school, got a master's degree in journalism. And then from there on, I worked at magazines for, you know, like maybe 15 years. I started working at Vibe, and then I worked at Entertainment Weekly, and then I worked a lot for Essence. I never was on staff at Essence, but I, you know, did a lot of freelance writing for them and editing, and then, you know, different magazines. That was my career. And then I started teaching in journalism in Philadelphia at Temple University, but all through there, I was writing. I was always freelance writing or freelance editing. And when I started working at Entertainment Weekly in the late 90s, that's when I wrote my first book, Hair Story, Untangling the Roots of Black Hair in America. And Hair Story actually started as my thesis in graduate school. And when I was working at Entertainment Weekly, I felt really guilty as a Black person who had been raised to believe that my work should move the needle somehow towards like racial justice. Like, I was raised with a lot of privilege. I mean, we weren't wealthy, but I went to private schools and I went to a really good college, and I had advantages, you know, that a lot of other people didn't have. And my parents always made me feel like, clearly you're going to go do something important in the world. Writing about Jennifer Aniston and Brad Pitt did not feel like I was moving the race forward. And I just was like, at that moment, I was like, this isn't doing the work. Mm. And so it's paying my bills, but it's not doing the work. And that's when I committed to writing Hair Story. I had previously met my co-author when we worked at Vibe magazine, and we had talked about writing a book together. And we had actually gone all the way through of like writing a proposal, but we were scared to put it out in the world. And that night, again, it was like a late night waiting for Brad Pitt's publicist to confirm something about banana milkshakes to me. And I was like, I have to do something. And it was like the next day, I sent out our proposal to an agent that we had been, you know, thinking about sending our proposal to. And that just, it actually turned out to be a pretty quick acceptance by an agent. Our agent was like, if you write a good proposal, you know, if you get this in shape and you write your sample chapters, I think I can sell this. She sold it pretty quickly. And that began my career, where I told myself that magazine writing, which I enjoyed, but I was always doing pop culture stuff. I was always doing pop culture stories for the most part, pop culture, entertainment, that kind of thing. And so then my books that I wrote was the way that I felt like I was contributing to advancing the position of Black culture in a higher place in American, like in the conversation about American culture. So Hair Story with my first book. And then I wrote a memoir, Kinky Gazpacho, which is my life story, obviously, but kind of speaking about my identity as a Black woman growing up in mostly white spaces and then traveling and seeing what that felt like to be Black in other places. And then I finally wrote my novel, Substitute Me. And then my fourth book was called Same Family, Different Colors. And that was a book that felt like the sister book to Hair Story, because it was about colorism. And it was about colorism in African-American community, the Latino community, the Asian-American community, and the mixed race community. So yeah, so my writing, my books have felt like what I am staking my claim as a change agent. And my magazine work is the fun stuff.
You gave us the whole journey. It's interesting to me, the number of writers who come on this show and declare that creative writing is not a real job. Like, I think that's like, that sucks, because, you know, I don't think white writers maybe feel like that. And I mean, I can't speak for them, I don't know, but it does feel like a very Black thing to say, like, okay, so what's your real job going to be? Like, you just write? Like, how do you make money? type of deal. In deciding that your books were going to be the area where you were doing change agent kind of work, does it ever get tiring where you feel like you need to have a point to make or to say to have a book go in the world? Like, you can't just, like, write fun, frivolous things because it's fun and frivolous?
You know, that's so funny, because that's where I am in my life. I just made this monumentous move. I left the United States and moved to Spain in 2021. And, you know, when people are like, why did you make that move in the middle of a pandemic? And I had just made tenure at my university. Like, I had ascended to all the places that I was supposed to get to, you know, with my career. People thought I was crazy for multiple reasons. But I am married to a Spaniard, so it wasn't like I just picked a random place to move out to. But I think because of the pandemic and because of what I call Black Lives Matter 2.0, you know, sort of sparked by the murder of George Floyd, etc., mm-hmm. It made me have that kind of reckoning of, like, you know, life isn't promised on any level. Life isn't promised. And if you're waiting for something, that's really dumb, because you don't know if it's ever going to come to pass that you have this perfect moment. So I moved to Spain literally to do addressing what you just asked me, which is that, you know, why do I have to do journalism to be a writer? Mm-hmm. You know, when can I write romance novels, which is what I literally grew up, like, secretly reading and loving. Like, I mean, I used to sneak my aunt's Harlequins when everybody else was reading, like, Judy Blume, you know, the teen Judy Blumes. I was like, girl, have you seen these Harlequin romances? I would devour them. My aunt had a subscription, so she had, like, boxes of them under her bed. And so me and my cousin would always read all these romances. Anyway, like, I, for a long time, I was like, yeah, I'm going to be a romance writer. This is it. This is it. So moving to Spain was, like, my decision that I was finally going to allow myself to be the writer that I wanted to be when I was, you know, 10 years old, where creative writing was what I was going to do. Novels, short stories, romance, children's books, you know, be a creative writer. And the reason I could do this in Spain is because healthcare and university education are not cost prohibitive. I don't have to worry that I can't send my kids to college, because college can be like $1,000 for the whole year. And healthcare is socialized here. So I don't have to worry that I'm going to die of, like, the flu, because I can't afford to go to the doctor or send my children to the doctor. So yeah, so my like moment, like, this is my moment to say, like, I don't have to be a change agent. I don't have to write serious hard stories to be A, to have a job, and B, to claim the title of writer. Like, I really am excited for this, like, second half of my life to, as a writer, to embrace the idea that I can, not only can I write fun stuff, beautiful stuff, stuff that lights up my soul, stuff about Black people in Spain or Morocco, or, you know, just having these like amazing fantasy, not fantasy, but like fantastic, glorious, beautiful, delicious lives. And that's also, I feel, moving the race forward, if you will, because we deserve to have these stories, right? We deserve to have these stories. And as writers, we deserve to write them and not feel like every story has to be, you know, some heavy exploration of our traumatic past.
How free do you feel? Because it sounds so liberating.
Well, it will be. And this is also just part of the writer's life, is that I have started doing ghostwriting to be my like 9-to-5 writer's job. And I have been working back to back on ghost projects. So it is only now, literally now, that I'm able to really begin this free life that I had planned for myself. I mean, it's absolutely delightful. Not only am I writing, I'm painting. I'm not a painter, but I feel that as a creative person, that we need to, that our writing isn't just sitting down at our desks. You know, to be a writer, you have to go and live in the world, and you have to express yourself and feel and write poetry and paint and, you know, collect rocks and pick flowers and all of that. You know, if you're going to write beautifully, you have to see beauty in all these different places and all these different ways. So I have had the opportunity to do those things here that I never did those things when I lived in Philadelphia, when I was working in academia and, you know, writing on the side or in my basement office, trying to, you know, snatch a piece here and a piece there.
So you mentioned ghostwriting. How many ghostwriting projects have you done so far?
2 officially. I'm finishing my 3rd, and I've done another big project that nobody will never know that I did because it was such a ghost project. And I had to sign an NDA on it to, you know, I'm seriously ghosting. Nobody should know. Nobody will know that I ever did it, which is fine. I mean, that's how some things work. And I actually fell into ghostwriting. So it wasn't something I was pursuing, but it turned out to be very lucrative. Originally, it was just like I was doing it as a favor for somebody. And then I realized that this was an actual profession and a skill set that could be utilized for, you know, for financial gain. And it also, I mean, I think of every writing project as a learning experience, but really looking at it more as like, oh, I could do one ghost project a year for money and then have more time the rest of the time to do my own projects.
How do you fall into someone else's voice story? Do you approach it like fiction as a ghostwriter, or do you like take notes, transcription? Like, what is that like?
Yeah, it's really interesting because every project is different. Some people that you're working with feel themselves to be good storytellers, good writers, and maybe they have already written something. And so you're kind of just helping them shape what they've written. My first project was with Ibtihaj Muhammad, the Muslim fencer. And my second project was with 2 people, Bobby Love and his wife, Cheryl Love, whose story was featured in Humans of New York. He was a young man who got caught up in the criminal justice system after robbing several banks, and then he escaped prison. So in both of those stories, both of those situations, Ibtihaj and Bobby Love and his wife, Cheryl Love, they're not writers, right? So the way I work with people is that I interview them and I work from transcripts. And then from transcripts, I have to use my skills as a storyteller to, you know, turn it into a story, because obviously somebody speaking is not what you want to read on the page, right? And so my skills as both a memoirist, a journalist, and a creative writer all come into play, because just as an example, someone may tell a story about, you know, the time they met their girlfriend, you know, the first time they saw them. And I can ask them, you know, what did she look like? What did you notice? But they're not going to tell me what the setting was like. They're not going to tell me, you know, exactly, you know, what the people around them were doing, you know, those kinds of details that writers know that you need to fill in a scene, but somebody just recounting a part of their lives may not. So that's that's basically how I work, is through lots and lots of interviewing. Before the pandemic, like, for example, when I worked with Iftihaj, I had the opportunity to go to her home and talk to her parents. So again, it's really journalism in, you know, finding all these other people who can fill, even though the story is told in her voice, you know, the more I can, you know, get into their lives and see where they do their thing, where they were born, that kind of thing, the better.
I think that feels the nosy part of every journalist, where you get to go and just like dig all in their lives, because yes, it's the yes. job.
That's it. That's why I love being a journalist, because I'm just super nosy.
Samesies. It's like you want to know everything. Mm-hmm. So you mentioned that you were doing this in Spain, mm-hmm. and you wrote a blog post about the word for ghost writer in Spain, and it's not very favorable. So let's talk about that. What is the word for ghostwriter in Spanish, and how are you referred to by profession in Spain?
Yeah, so the word for ghostwriter in Spain, the word is negro, or negro literario, like literary black person, but it's more, the term is more referring to like slave. So, which is the same in French, like the Spanish copied the French, and the French term is actually what the translation would be, like the N-word. Like that's their word for it. And that was because, I mean, there's a long history to it, but the idea is a ghostwriter does all the work and gets no credit, like a slave, like a black person. And so it feels pejorative. It feels racist. Because you're saying, you're saying the work I'm doing is, again, you're doing all the work, you get no credit. And who does that kind of work? Black people, right? I mean, so at a base level, it's completely racist. But it also speaks to this profession, which I am firmly entrenched in and am getting paid and can't complain fully. But I will say that some of the projects I've done have made me feel like that, like I am doing all of this work and you will never know that I did any of it. And as a writer, as a person who identifies as a writer who wants her
the
name
credit,
in life,
yeah,
right, I mean,
like you want the byline, you want
exactly.
to see by
exactly. I don't think I'm actually very well cut out for this work, because I am too ego driven in that sense, where if I did all this work, two of the books that I've done, my name is right on the cover. And I always ask for that credit, cover credit, because I mean, if I wrote this book, I want the credit for it. That's, I feel like that should be a given.
Mm-hmm.
The New York Times just wrote this long piece after Prince Harry's book just came out, Spare, because everybody was talking about his ghostwriter. And this brought up this conversation about just what, you know, nobody knows who Prince Harry's ghostwriter is except the ghostwriting community, right? Mm-hmm. If you look at the cover of his book, it does not say Prince Harry and his ghostwriter.
Right.
You know, even, I don't even think it says it on the inside cover. It might, I'm not sure. But the point is, the media will be like, oh, look at this book that Celebrity X or Celebrity Y wrote. And the celebrity is like, oh, I just finished my book. When
you didn't. The ghostwriter finished your book.
Who just did all this work. Did all that, wrote the book. You did not write the book. You didn't go through the 16,000 edits with your editor. You didn't do all the fact check. Like, you didn't do anything in terms of what it means to actually write a book. To me, there's something inherently wrong with this profession when the ghost doesn't get any credit. So I do feel, you know, having done this now four times, that there is something. Like, I feel like the Spanish and the French, even though it's obviously very pejorative and they weren't thinking about it this way, but the fact that they acknowledge this job is the person does all the work and gets none of the credit, that is actually what ghostwriters do. And there are people who are like, I don't want to be a writer. I don't have my own stories to tell. I enjoy helping other people telling their stories. This is, you know, they specialize in it. They're very good at it. They enjoy the process. They like getting to know powerful, important people and helping them, you know, do whatever they want to do. and they go home, collect their paycheck, and get the next one. And it is a profession. So I'm not suggesting that nobody should do it, but they definitely, I think if the point I am trying to make is that there's definitely a personality that's well suited for it. And there should be, I feel like, more acknowledgement by book reviewers, the media in general, that if they're like, wow, what a great book, but you know good and well that that person is not a writer. They didn't write that book. Mm-hmm. Like, at least acknowledge, or at least ask the question, oh, so you have a new book out, you know, business person of the day. What was it like to work with a ghostwriter to write this book, as opposed to tell us what it was like to write this book? Because you know they didn't. We should be more transparent about that process to give credit to the people who are doing that work.
It reminds me of when President Obama's memoir came out of Promised Land. And I remember the reviews and everything. And one, I think it might have been the New York Times that said, you know, presidential memoirs usually come out 1 or 2 years after the presidency, but it had been like 4 because it came out as Trump was leaving office. And one of the remarks was, and it took so long because he wrote it himself. Like, that was like the marvel. And it also makes me think of, I don't know, when Janelle Monáe's book came out and she went on CBS This Morning and she was sitting there and they're talking to her about the book and she's shouting out all of the authors who helped her write these short stories that her name is on. And like, mm-hmm. she kept saying their names and then the interviews are trying to push back and say, well, you wrote this and you'd had this story and this is that. And she's trying to shout out all the people who helped her shape it. I thought that was a very interesting dichotomy, but I wonder, is it because you've had books, your own books with your own byline, your, you know, your journalism, your memoir, your creative nonfiction, your fiction, that you know what it is to, for what it's worth, be front and center with a project, with your name on it? So then stepping like behind that curtain and assuming the role of ghostwriter just feels like it's a coat that doesn't fit type of deal. And I mean, it is ego, but I mean, it's also that it's ego and it's work that's almost thankless.
Yes, Nikisha, that's it exactly. So that's why I'm saying that this is not a job for every writer, right? Like, I'm actually thinking about teaching a class on ghostwriting because it is very lucrative, but I would caution people that, because what is the joy of a writer? To see your words in print, right? Like, that's the joy. Like, when you see your words in print and you see your words out in the world and you see other people reading them and being moved by them. The only difference when you're doing it as a ghost is like your name isn't on it. So people can't say, wow, Lori, what a great job. Like, this book moved me. And so there's that level. I mean, that's what we as writers want. We want to move people with our work. We want to see the effect it has on them. Or, you know, depending on what the story is, whether it's fiction or nonfiction, we're putting it out in public to have a reaction, right? So there's that. And then there's also, like, again, if you do this work, and I think this would be true of anything. I mean, if you baked a cake and you spend all your time and energy, you bought the ingredients, you mix it up, you use your mama's recipe, right? And you put it in a cake contest and somebody else is like, oh, I made this cake. You'd be like, excuse me? No, you didn't. Oh, well, I put the candles on it, or I put the decorations on it. You would be really mad. I mean, your instinct is to say, but I did this work. How come I'm not getting the credit for it? And it's not, I don't think there's anything wrong with that. I mean, I think that's natural if you put your heart and soul into something, and especially if this is your talent, if this is your gift. I mean, I probably wouldn't be as upset if I did make a cake and I gave it to my sister. My sister can't cook. And I was like, girl, tell him you made it. Just go ahead and tell him you made it. I wouldn't care. It's not like I make my livelihood on cakes, right?
Right.
But if this is something I have perfected and this is my livelihood, this is what I do, and I don't get the credit for it, then it does make me think, like, what am I doing this for? Like, I could have written another book of my own in the same time period. So it's all of these things. It's a head game, really. Mm-hmm. And as I'm saying this, I try to think, is there another profession where somebody goes, I've created a whole thing from my brain and you may take the credit for it. That's kind of crazy. I mean, what other businesses or professions do we do that?
I don't think there is maybe another profession where it's done like that, but I think there are examples of it in other industries. And I think most notably with books and writing, how many books are adapted into movies or into TV shows, and then those shows and those movies are more remembered than the book. And the characters that are portrayed by these actors are more remembered than the author who actually wrote the story. I think that doesn't happen all the time. Like, you know, with The Color Purple, you will always know that that's an Alice Walker novel. And the novel, in all of its iterations, it's the novel that's the base. But that doesn't happen with every book. And
absolutely.
Like, I think Queen Sugar. Like, I feel like more people have watched the show than have read Natalie Bazile's book. And that's a little problematic. So it may not be the same as, you know, where you're completely hitting. But I do think that a lot of time with writing in general, that the work of the writer who may not enjoy the spotlight or just is not even thrust into it is then co-opted by other people in another role. Screenwriters, for example, like you'll see a movie and it's this brainchild of this screenwriter and you have no idea unless you're reading the credits, like original screenplay by, but it's the actors who get all the credit and it's the directors who get all the credit and that type of thing. So I think writers are just like not thanked enough, I think is maybe what I'm getting at. Like there need to be more thank yous because you wouldn't have all the content on all these streaming platforms without the writers to write them.
I agree 100%, Nikisha, and that's why I love your podcast so much. I think that one of the reasons that we don't big up the writers is because we don't big up writers, right? We just don't have the platforms. You know, a friend of mine just won the NAACP award, and, you know, they don't put them on the big night. You know, they're on the night before. Nobody sees them, you know, on the big show. And you're so right. Who sits and waits for the screenplay credits on the movie? It's the director. It's the actors, right? So I hear you 100%. And that's, I mean, the new platform that I just launched, Read, Write, and Create, part of my journey as, you know, really embracing my own desire to do creative writing is to also just elevate creative writers and what we do and put it as not just something you do by yourself on the typewriter, on the computer, in a corner in your little office, but as a lifestyle. Like the literary lifestyle is particularly for Black writers and other writers of color is what my whole emphasis on this part of my life is all about. It's like literary tourism, like a literary lifestyle, you know, incorporating this idea that books and writing are as important and as exciting as fundamental to any other aspect of popular culture, and that this is what has to happen for the writers to get the respect, right? Those of us who are into content creation and media, you know, to make sure that we are creating content that uplifts the writers, that showcases the writers, because, you know, we're a pop culture based society. And if we don't see it on TikTok, Instagram, you know, if it's not on the Today Show, right? If it's not streaming on Disney, then I guess it's not real or it's not important. And so I feel like we have to kind of train people. We have to train the writers themselves to take up space, but we also have to train the world to recognize that, like you just said, without the writers, you don't have anything. You don't have the stories. You don't have anything.
So you talked about your new platform, Read, Write, Create. Tell us more about it. Like, so what is it? Where can people find it? What are you trying to do? Give us the whole rundown.
It's called Read, Write, and Create. And the tagline is a sanctuary for BIPOC writers. And basically, it is an online platform. It's a blog and a podcast where I provide resources for BIPOC writers. So resources being everything from just inspirational pep talks on the podcast to, you know, blog posts that are a compilation of all of the writing retreats for BIPOC writers specifically that are happening in this, you know, calendar year, for example. Calls for writers, open submissions, contests. I'm planning on hosting my first retreat in the south of Spain for BIPOC writers later this year. And I'm trying to...
I want
to
come.
I hope you do. I'm doing workshops and classes and really trying to become the Black woman who really highlights literary tourism for people as well. Because it's this is what I'm talking about, is that if we don't highlight what, you know, how encompassing like the literary lifestyle can be, then people don't recognize it. And literary tourism is what I do naturally, and it's a thing. But when we think about literary tourism, it's like you go to England and you find out where Jane Austen lived, right? Or you go to Charles Dickens' house. Well, I don't read Jane Austen. Charles Dickens is not on my list of people who I want to meet. But nonetheless, if I was on my own and I'm doing literary tourism, it's like I'm going to James Baldwin's Paris, right? I want to go to Zora Neale Hurston's Eatonville. I want to, of course, because I'm in Spain, you know, I am all about finding Langston Hughes. Langston Hughes was here covering the Civil War in the 1930s, and he was in Madrid and Barcelona. I'm trying to find out where he was so I can create these like a literary tour. If you want to see where Langston Hughes supposedly found his voice in Spain when he was here reporting. And so, you know, I would like to put markers in the places where Langston Hughes was reporting from when he was in Madrid and Barcelona, for example. So like my idea is to showcase that we as people of color who have our own literary heroes, that when we travel, which I feel like most people who are readers are also travelers, you know, but when we travel, we want to find the bookstores, we want to find the homes of our literary ancestors or heroes, whatever they might be. And, you know, create that as well. Like, I want to create this whole like ecosystem of sumptuous literary living for BIPOC writers and the people who love to read them. That's what I'm trying to do with this platform, Read, Write, and Create. Always elevating BIPOC writers because, you know, that's my people.
Amen. So then I know you're overprepared for this section. So let's get into this speed round in this game before we go for the afternoon. What is your favorite book?
So as a child, my favorite book was Anne of Green Gables, the whole series. As a young adult, I was really into romance. And there was this book called The Flame and the Flower by Kathleen E. Woodwiss. My current favorite is just the most recent book that I loved that I can't stop talking about is Black Cake by Charmaine Wilkerson.
Who is your favorite author?
Bernice McFadden. I will read anything that Bernice McFadden writes. Anything.
Favorite book to movie adaptation?
I think I'm going to have to go with... it's a tie between The Color Purple, which I know almost everybody says that on your show, but it is really, really good. But also, I'm going to say The Road to Saint Anna. It's a James McBride book that actually I did not like, but the movie was amazing.
Didn't
that
Spike do the movie?
Yes, exactly. Yes,
Spike did the movie.
I thought the movie was really good. And then I went back. I'd never heard of the book. Went back and read the book. I was like, oh, no. I love James McBride. I mean, almost every other James McBride book I love. But that one, I was like, what is happening? I can't even follow this. But the movie was excellent.
So I have to throw you curveball questions now because you're so prepared. Top three literary tourism hotspots.
Paris, because of James Baldwin. Zora Neale Hurston's Eatonville, Florida. And I am about to go to Morocco. So I can't say specifically, but I know this is a really fun fact. The very first public library is in Morocco, and I believe it's in Fez, in their capital. And it was founded by a woman, a Muslim woman, created the world's first library.
That sounds like something a Black woman would do because it's Morocco, which is in Africa. So we're going to say she's Black.
Yeah.
It sounds like what we do in the world, that a Black woman created the world's first library. We're going to claim it unless you tell us otherwise.
I am going to be writing a post about it so people can come and fact check me. I will double, triple check. But Literary Morocco will be my first like literary itinerary on the Read, Write, and Create blog. So, you know, y'all come and fact check it and see if I was accurate. I will know the truth. I know one of, for sure, library founded by a woman, one of the oldest, if not the first library in the world.
That's awesome. So you're already an expat and living like this fabulous life in Spain where you get to travel to all these places. But if money were truly no object, where would you go? What would you do? And where would you live?
Okay. I would go to Zanzibar, which on the east coast of Kenya, right? Only because it just sounds so cool. And I've seen pictures that make it look so beautiful. And I would do exactly what I'm doing now. I would be reading, I would be writing, but I would be dipping my feet in the beautiful crystal blue ocean surrounded by beautiful Black people and probably leading like literary workshops in Zanzibar. Because, I mean, come on, come and write with me in Zanzibar. It just sounds wonderful. That's what I would do.
Name three things on your bucket list.
Oof. My bucket list is really, it's kind of done already. So the three things were, I wanted to be a mother, I wanted to be an author, and I wanted to live abroad. And I did that, had my baby and my first book in the same year. They both came out in 2001, my first book and my first child. And I moved to Spain 2021. So like, and I'm saying that, like I said before, I moved to Spain because I was like, it's now or never. I mean, we don't have tomorrow's not promised. Mm-hmm. And I'm a big proponent in not having a bucket list and then dying and have it like do
and
what you
still
can do
having
now.
A bucket list. Yeah.
Yeah. Do what you can do now.
What brings you joy?
My children bring me joy. My two older sons have had some difficult times and they're both on the other side of those things. And like I said, because being a mom was one of my bucket list items. When they were struggling, it was really hard for me because I thought that was what I was supposed to do, was be a mom. And when they were struggling, I was like, so I did something wrong or I didn't do enough. And so all three of my children are here now with me in Spain as of like 3 days ago. And it's just joyful to have healthy, happy children. It's, you know, they're 21, 18, and 11. The 11-year-old is just a doll. She's a doll. She's still innocent, so that's fine. But the older ones, it really is a joy to see your young Black sons content with their life and looking forward to the future. That's a blessing. And the other thing that brings me joy, of course, reading, but also really good food.
So like, what's the best Spanish dish that you've had since you've been abroad?
Girl, please don't ask me that because now I'm going to have to say something nasty. Spanish, like my tongue is bored because Spanish food it's good. Don't get me wrong. It is good, but it's very plain. Like the three spices are, yeah, it's bland.
It's bland.
It's bland. Because like there's like three spices, paprika, salt, and garlic, which can be delicious. But I'm bored. It's been 2 years. The best dish that I've had here are the ones that I make. Like I make Jamaican curries. I just made a new Trinidadian shrimp curry. Like I gotta mix it up.
I'm coming to visit.
Here.
It's official. We're friends. I'm coming to visit and we're gonna eat in.
I will cook for you. I mean, if you're new here, I'll be like, oh, taste all these lovely things. And then after 3 days, you'd be like, I'm bored. And I'll be like, I'll cook for you now.
Yes. All right. So then what brings you peace?
Walking on the beach. I'm in Malaga. I'm right on the beach. I literally can see the ocean from the Mediterranean from my window.
Yes. Goals. Okay. So rewriting the classics. Name one book you wish you would have written.
Anything by Jesmyn Ward. Anything.
Pick a book.
Thing I'm buried saying.
Okay. What's one book where you want to change the ending and how would you do it?
In Yaa Gyasi's, I don't know if I'm pronouncing her last name right, Homegoing, I just would have made the love story happen sooner towards the end. Like, I feel like the ending was the good part. Like, the ending was the final resolution of the love story. And that was so much of the, I wanted it to happen earlier. That's probably the only thing that I would have, that the change that I would make.
Okay. And then name a book that you think is overrated and why?
I'm just going to say, like, Shakespeare in general. Which is probably a big thing to say, but I just don't see what the big deal about Shakespeare is. Like, I feel like the work is supposed to be so foundational. And I know there's things that I'm not saying don't teach Shakespeare, but to act like Shakespeare is the greatest thing since sliced bread for the literary world, especially since according to my research, Shakespeare was really a pen name for a woman. Like, it's a woman who did all this work.
I was going to say, like, didn't Shakespeare have a ghostwriter?
Yes. Who was a woman who didn't get any credit. Again, you know.
Full circle moment here.
Yes. But so that's my I feel like Shakespeare is so intimidating. And so we tell people like, oh, yes, Shakespeare is the best. And it's so important. And it's if you don't like it or you don't understand it, it's almost like shameful to admit that, like, yeah, I didn't really get it, or I didn't think it was that good, or I wasn't moved by these characters or something like that. And I feel like it should be okay to take him and not enjoy his work or not get it or not feel moved by it, mm-hmm. and not feel like you should be ashamed that you're not a big fan of Shakespeare, right?
Got it. And so my final question for you today, Lori, when you are dead and gone and among the ancestors, what would you like someone to write about the legacy of work and words that you left behind?
I hope that people look at my work and see stories, both true and fictionalized, that try to expand the definition of the Black experience. I hope that, yeah, that the work I leave behind really says this is a woman who wanted people to understand that the Black experience was not singular, and that she advocated for Black people's stories to be told widely and expansively.
Amen. Thank you, Lori.
Welcome.
Big thank you to Lori L. Tharps for being here today on Black and Published. Make sure you check out Lori's new platform for BIPOC writers, Read, Write, and Create. And if you're not following Lori, check her out on the socials. She's at Lori L. Tharps on Instagram. That's our show for the week and the season. If you like this episode and want more Black and Published, head to our Instagram page. It's at Black and Published, and that's BLK and Published. Also, like and subscribe on your favorite podcast app and share the show with a friend. I'll be back for season 4 in 2024. Mama needs a hiatus, okay? But I'll talk to you then. Peace.